This episode of Yes But Why podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Download your free audiobook today at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why podcast. Yeah.
At my university, American University in Bulgaria, we formed the very first university improv club in the Balkans. We think, we're not sure. But it's certainly the first English language improv club in the Balkans. And so, as you know, just in the United States, almost every university has improv teams, multiple improv teams, you know, doing short form and long form. So we were very excited in the last year to create, the students wanted to do improv, even though they didn't really know what it was, and just, you know, do some performing, because I do some improv exercise in psychology to illustrate some principles and about the brain and things like that. And so we're doing it, and we have our very first show scheduled involving the students in the club and faculty in about a month on the 14th of November, which we're all very excited about, and we're just kind of preparing for that in the meantime.
How do they feel? Yeah. Are they like excited? I understand how it is with like new improvisers. The stage, the audience is the scariest part.
It really is. They're excited and they're very nervous. What we're going to do is do a series of short form games that are kind of genuine, real audience pleasers that are very fast and, you know, are very, very low stakes. They're sort of the grade school soccer version of improv. So if you miss something, nobody cares. Because nobody will remember, because there's something happening right after that should be fun and funny. Yeah. So the students are going to do about 20 minutes of short form. And then I have asked, we have like a 40, 50 some faculty, and I wanted them to do what's called PowerPoint roulette. Have you ever heard of this? Or PowerPoint karaoke?
I don't know. Is it like doing a TED talk without knowing what's behind you? I've done those.
That's exactly correct. It's doing, you get a bunch of random PowerPoints together, and you have 6 minutes or 7 minutes to go through all of the PowerPoints and make up a lecture on the spot of which you are seeing for the very first time.
I love that.
Yeah, I did a very brief version of this at a talent show last year. It is terrifying, but it's super, super fun. And I put the call out for faculty to do this, and I was surprised to get 6 people who wanted to sign up. And I said, are you sure? Because here's really what's going to happen. And you can watch these videos of other people doing this, and some people do great, some people do terrible. And everyone said, yeah, no, we want to try and do it. It will be fun. So this will be a show in the evening for all the students and faculty and staff at the university. And it's designed to really kind of show the human side of faculty for basically first years who are very terrified of everything that's happening to them right now. They're going to university in a country that they don't know, and with instructors they don't know, in a second language. And so it's designed to just kind of put everybody at ease. So I hope in some ways it's going to be like a total disaster and say, you know what, it doesn't matter, because, you know, we all had fun, and that's all that really matters with this. So we'll see what happens. I'll let you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so nice that the teachers want to be part of the experience and to allow themselves to look silly in front of the students, you know, to show their human side. How did you get into developing these kinds of things for your school. I mean, it's not your job to sort of do community events, is it? Or is like, and you don't teach improv, like that's not your, what you're teaching at the university, right? How'd you get involved with bringing this all to the community?
So if you work at a university, if you're on faculty, you have to do some sort of activities in addition to your teaching to, sort of justify your existence and bolster your dossier. And my university doesn't have tenure. They have contracts. And so every few years you have your contract, you offer your contract to be renewed. And so I'm not an administrator. I don't like to do administrative things. I don't like to set up, I don't like to do things like review the curriculum of all the different disciplines and things like that. But one of the committees that I could have, that I joined was called the Faculty Life Committee. And because it's all about improving and taking care of faculty in stress and making them more comfortable and so on. And so all the other thing that you can do is be a faculty sponsor for the student-run club. So I'm the faculty co-sponsor of the psychology club for our university because I'm a psychology professor and it's sort of a natural thing to do. I did a TEDx talk a couple years ago at my university, so I'm the faculty sponsor for the TEDx club at the university. And then, you know, again, it's a little bit selfish, but for my own self, because I like to do improv and I like to perform, and there's very few outlets for me to perform here. The second best thing is teaching. And so teaching improv. And so I asked some students who seemed to like some of the improv demonstrations that I did in class, you know, we can do this as a club, but you guys have to form the club. I'll be the faculty sponsor if you want to do it. And so we did a couple of recruiting events for the club that was pretty well attended. And, you know, we just did like an hour and a half, you know, open workshop on what improv is. And we had like 20 students sign up. And the great thing about it is that 17 of those students are women.
Wow.
There's three guys that showed up. And it's just exactly the opposite of, you know, what you experience in most places where maybe it's closer to 50-50 in
no,
the States.
It is not.
Certainly
no.
No,
it's still all
here
dudes.
In Eastern Europe. Yeah, I know. There's still a lot of, it's like a boys club.
Yeah.
But in Eastern Europe, it's the vast majority is almost all men. And so this was just a nice reversal. And I think the students who are going to perform in the show are going to be all women, which is just going to be great. And they're going to be fantastic. It's going to be super fun.
It would seem that the people at your university would inherently be brave to be sort of at the university itself. So do you find that your improv club students are, you know, really sinking their teeth into it? Or are you like, you know, easing them slowly into, you know, figuring it out? How's it going?
Well, it's tough. And it's tough for a couple of reasons. Of about half the students that are in the club, we've been working with over the past year. So they're sort of the veterans.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other half are people who have really just learned and have come to the club two or three times at most. And so they're very, very, very new. And so you really get to see, and I was how different it is when even if you've got just, you know, a dozen workshops under your belt or just a dozen club meetings of just saying yes and adding things and just being relaxed and having fun and not worrying about mistakes. And there, it just really makes my heart sing to watch the more experienced students say, oh no, it's okay to fail. In fact, we have this thing called the failure bow, and they do the failure bow and all the other students are clapping, you know, when they're doing a failure bow and stuff. And it's just really great.
Tell me how you think the failure bow helps. I've heard about that. I've never used it, but I am interested in it. Tell me about it, how it works for you guys.
You know that look on people's faces as beginners when they think that they're making a mistake and they're just like yelling at themselves, and they're just, they're, you know, their eyebrows are together and they're looking downwards and they're just kind of saying, either sometimes out loud or to themselves, that was stupid, that was dumb. And I would interrupt that in the beginning and say, listen, there are no mistakes here, but if you do think that you've made a mistake, don't keep it to yourself. Celebrate it by telling us that you yelled out loud, I made a mistake, and take a huge bow. And the more elaborate the bow that you can make while you're saying, I made a mistake or I failed, we will cheer you. And the idea is to stop that cycle of denigrating yourself for doing something wrong, and to just let everybody know how many mistakes that you and everybody else makes, and the fact that there's nothing bad that will happen because you did make a mistake. In fact, something good will happen because we all like applause and we all like this idea that we're human. And I find it to be a really great equalizer. I learned this in Texas. I learned this at the Hideout.
Yeah.
They just really emphasize, particularly in narrative improv, of just, you know, taking a bow when you feel like you did something that was a mistake. And then after a while, it's like, okay, the mistakes don't matter anymore. And in fact, it's kind of fun to make a mistake because guess what? I get to do a failure bow to call myself out and to call myself out on how ridiculous it is to berate myself for making mistakes. It's a great lesson. And particularly for university students, international university students from Eastern Europe who have basically been told all their lives that you cannot make mistakes. If you take a risk, you had better make sure that you're going to be successful. If you are not going to be successful, do not take risks, because the people who take risks are fools if there's no guarantee that you're going to be successful. The classic expression here is that the nail that sticks up gets pounded down.
Interesting. I've heard that in Japan too.
Yes. Yeah. So yeah. It's very common in more collectivistic societies.
Interesting.
Where you don't want to stand out. And you certainly don't want to make a mistake, and you certainly don't want to be caught making a mistake. So the failure bow kind of addresses that as well.
Man, I could go down so many political roads right now, but we're going to talk about improv. I was like, ooh, man, I have so many thoughts about this. This is such an interesting, just like the idea of this and like how it works and just the failure bow and how it's working for your particular community. It's just so cool. I'm really fascinated by it. I think that is really amazing. You've been having this improv journey of your own. How do you feel like how do you feel like you got here? I mean, you don't have to tell me your whole history, but like, right, what was the first time in your life when you were a kid or high school or whatnot, when you felt like you did something creative and you were like, this is something that's important to me?
Well, I was listening to a podcast with Jill Bernard the other day, and somebody asked, the interviewer asked her where she got started, and she sort of always realized, she said that she really liked making people laugh when she was a kid, singing funny songs and stuff like that. And when I heard her, I almost started crying, because that's exactly how I felt as a kid. I was the youngest of a big family, youngest of 8 boys. And so, you know, making your older siblings laugh was like the only power that I had. And so I always liked doing that. And when I was in middle school, I wanted to be an actor and act in certain things. But again, the sort of the pressure, my older brothers were all into sports and I was not. Mm. And it was sort of known, it was made very clear to me that being part of the theater club or being in that in middle school and high school was not cool. It was not a good thing. And so I didn't do it stupidly. I did gravitate towards music and playing in a rock band in high school and in my early 20s and through most of my that life, but I never did theater. And the only time I discovered improv was in the 90s when I was in a band, and the lead singer in my band worked for a company in Chicago that at the time was sort of the Groupon of Chicago, where all the improvisers worked. And she said, we've been invited to go to an opening of the permanent space for this comedy club called Improv Olympic. And my personal assistant, a guy named Kevin Dorf, acts in this improv group. And we went, and it was just amazing. I remember just thinking that these guys, and it was all guys at the time, this group were going to be great and famous. And how did they do that? And there was no way that this was all made up, and just all the normal reactions that people have from seeing really good improv for the first time. And that was just, that was in the 90s, and we went to see shows quite a lot. And I got to see the very first Armando Diaz experience with Armando Diaz as Armando, and seeing the birth of the Armando and all those things happening. And then much, much later in grad school, I needed something fun to do. And so I saw an ad on a bus to take improv classes. And so I started to do it as a way of just not being miserable writing my dissertation. My dissertation was on community psychology and how people recover from addiction. And then when I sort of got involved with improv and the idea of group mind and supporting each other, the concept of that as an improv group really fit in well with the idea of mutual support for people recovering from addictions. And so at that point, I was just completely hooked as an academic, learning how improv could help form communities of people who are trying to achieve a more or less singular goal, like recover from addictions or, put on a performance on stage. And then personally, just having something really, really fun to do and maybe teaching it to other people who also wanted to form communities around certain things.
Did you ever put any improv theory discussion in your dissertation?
I did not. I was not
probably smart.
I was not advanced enough, but I have since gotten to know some people on Facebook who are doing, have done their master's or PhDs on theatrical improv. And of course, you're probably familiar with the Applied Improv Network. There's lots and lots of academics doing stuff in there that is interesting. The field of actually doing research on improv is pretty wide open. As far as I know, nobody has done any real random controlled trials or real experimental group designs to study what the actual effects of improv are. It's a lot of anecdotal things or single group studies. And so maybe someday I'll do some research on that. But at this point, I have no plans on doing that.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely not. I just figured if you were taking the class while you were writing your dissertation, sometimes, sometimes what's happening to you in your life, leaks into what I'm, certainly for me, it leaks into what I'm writing, even if I don't mean it. I'm like, oh, all of a sudden I'm writing about this. Like, it's just,
yeah,
like,
I mean, it absolutely, yeah, it's absolutely leaked in. How did it help? How did it leak into your writing?
Oh, for me, I mean, like I teach a lot. And so I teach the same thing over and over. So that's my, song I'm singing, I guess. And then, so I have to have a different point of view as I'm doing it each time. And every group teaches me something new. And also, like, I get in my head about certain things. So I end up, like, focusing on one specific idea while I'm teaching. And then when I'm doing that, all of a sudden those ideas find their way into sketches that I'm writing. You know, like if I'm super into characters, and because sometimes, I'll have a personal epiphany about like how something works. And if I am excited about how I understand it, then it helps me to explain it to especially new students. I teach a lot of level ones. And so when I'm mm-hmm. teaching people for the first time, if I'm excited about the way that my mind is grasping this, they're going to grab it a little bit more than if I'm like, yeah, so this is how you do it. But if I'm like, guys, listen to what I just figured out. Because it's like that. It's like, you know, I teach the same thing over and over. So I'm watching the same exercises. I'm watching the same stuff. And I'm fine with that. I think that that's good in the way that like people do meditation. And I, mm-hmm. but because of that, in the way that people do meditation, they get different things out of it. And so I'm getting different things out of teaching every time. And then, so I also teach sketch classes, which are writing. And then I'll use the things that I've learned to focus sketch stuff, or I'll write things. There have certainly been screenplays where like the path of the character ends up following down some discussion or something we had in an improv class. So, I mean, I find everything around me inspires me. So, I mean, that being said, you're writing a science dissertation, like no pressure to bring some theater in it because, you know, when you said that your family wasn't so into you being in theater, I feel like for many years, I feel like it's only very recently that it's cool to do theater and that it's like that a dad's going to be like, that's an acceptable career choice, son. Like, so, you know, idea that you were like, yeah, I'm not going to throw this theater jargon into my paper, probably best, because Lord knows who was reading it and they would have been like, what's this? So but as far as like you and your like journey, like, so I'm talking about like when I teach, I have all these ideas. Since you're, you know, teaching psychology and you're doing improv, both performing and teaching, how do those things mix in your life? Do you ever have like an idea that kind of pervades both and you get to explore it in different ways?
Yeah. So next semester, I am teaching the psychology of creativity. There's all these different theories about how to be creative. And I'm using a textbook written by a guy named Keith Sawyer. And he's been, you know, one of the forefront of people who, I mean, he actually played piano for improv groups in Chicago while he was at the University of Chicago and videotaped thousands and thousands of hours of actual improv shows of groups that I knew during that time in the 90s and analyzed the dialogue and came up with this theory of how improvised dialogue emerges and makes certain things. And I think he wrote his dissertation specifically on how groups can do creativity. And so since I don't know very much about it academically, I thought, well, what better way to learn about it than to teach it as part of a class, share it with a bunch of other students, and then I'm sure some things will jump out at me about this.
Totally.
So that's that bit. But the thing that is probably, I work with people who recover from addictions, mostly after they leave treatment, and how to prevent relapse. And in the United States, we have all these sort of system set up like halfway houses, you know, AA and 12-step groups are sort of ubiquitous. You can find them in almost every city in the United States. And so when I came to Eastern Europe, that was the main focus of my research. How do you prevent relapse? How do you do sort of community-based, very cheap, but, grassroots community-based interventions to help people recover from relapse? And there's nothing like that here. There's 12-step groups, but they're very, very, very small and not very ubiquitous. So just to give you a comparison, the city I live in here is Sofia. It's about 1.3 million people. Chicago, though, is, you know, it's a much bigger city. It's about 3 million people, but there are about 4,000 just Alcoholics Anonymous meetings in Chicago per week. And here in Sofia, there's about 20.
Whoa.
And so, you know, it's not, and the need is about, you know, similar. It's about, there's certainly hundreds of thousands of people who need it here in Sofia, but they just don't go. And so the big question that comes to any community psychologist is, well, why? Why are the services utilized so infrequently here, even though they're available and they're cheap and, you know, peer support and so on. And so over the course of several years, you learn that, you know, just levels of trust is very, very different here in Eastern Europe than it is in the United States. Believe it or not, in the United States, we are a high trust culture. Our relationships are very shallow in terms of friendships and so on, but we can establish the basic rules of our interaction very, very, very quickly. And we don't, if somebody violates that, it's to their detriment. It is not usually to the detriment of everybody else. Here in Eastern Europe, the relationships are very, very deep and they take a long, long time to formulate. And until you have that deep relationship, you do not trust other people. In fact, it's stupid and foolish to trust other people. And part of that is because of just the history of the Balkans, but part of that more has to do with how things were during Soviet times and under communism, where if you said or did the wrong thing, it would be very detrimental to yourself and or your family. And so who you chose to trust was very, very, very important. And you absolutely had to choose to trust people. And so what do we do in improv? We get up on stage, usually with people we don't know very well, and we're asked, trust them. Say yes to them. Say yes to everything that happens in a scene within a certain amount of safety and consent reason parameters. But say yes to everything. And here it's just, it's a very alien concept. And so the improv, and that influences the improv that happens here, where people tend to, there tends to be a lot of conflict or tends to be a lot of, I'm going to do whatever I can to thwart you because that's funny. And so those are how, that's an, just an example how the two things kind of have gone together.
That's the idea of trust is really interesting, especially too when it comes to addiction in a community. You know, I find that the biggest issue would be coming forward, like trusting that they can say, I have a problem, please help me, without it causing a big problem in their family or in their life. I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of people where it's gone too far. Everybody knows. It's not like a, it's not like, oh, really? But you know, certainly, and maybe a couple days ago it was, Mental Health Day, or so said Facebook. I was like, a lot of people were talking about, you know, stigmas and stuff like that. Do you think that there is a stigma when it comes to collecting, and that's why there aren't people in communities for addiction recovery, just as, because I'm fascinated.
I mean, there's a much heavier stigma on mental health in general here than there is in the United States. It's kept within the family. People don't talk about it. You don't see billboards about it. You don't see, you know, drug advertisement for it. I mean, part of that is, you know, the EU doesn't allow drug advertisement for mental health. So there's a lot of stigma. I mean, and officially during Soviet times, addiction didn't exist because everyone lived in a socialist paradise. And so, people absolutely did drink and people absolutely did do drugs, but they were hauled off and you basically never saw them again, either in prison or in a sanatorium. And so, yeah, that stigma still exists here. Some of it is the people who have been trained in the West, the professionals I know, they know for a fact that, you know, there's nothing shameful. It's it is a condition that can be treated successfully and people can go on and live happy lives. But, you know, they're a very tiny, tiny minority. And so the culture keeps it down. It's really about willpower. If you have a problem, you keep it in the family. You don't air your dirty laundry. And to show that you have a mental illness is a sign of weakness.
So it's got to be really hard for you to be doing what you're doing as far as community building. If everybody's super filled with shame, you know, at in my most shameful moments, I'm not looking for a pal. You know, like, I don't want to talk about it. And believe me, I'm probably in one of the more, you know, like liberal havens of the U.S. where they're like, it's okay, talk about it. Everyone loves you. But I'm still like, no, I won't be telling you what I really am thinking ever. So I don't know. It just seems like a fascinating group that you're working with. And I'm just fascinated by the work you're doing. I think you're great.
Well, thanks. I mean, it's extremely interesting. It's very frustrating as well because, I mean, you're talking about culture.
Yeah.
You're talking about really, really deep cultural structures. And I mean, but that's the amazing thing about doing any sort of international work or just doing, you know, international travel. You just get to see how other people in other cultures think about things. And, you know, why do people think that? I mean, a sort of a very seminal moment here when I first came to do this research was I was talking to a Bulgarian cab driver who spoke English, and I had a policy of just telling everybody who asked what I did. And I told him I worked with people with addictions, and this cab driver says, oh, you should just let him die. Just let him die.
God.
And I said, really? And he goes, no, in fact, it would be better just to shoot them. Put them out of their misery and put the families out of their misery. And I said, you know, and of course the natural reaction is to be horrified by this and to say you're a bad person, you have these horrible, backwards, stereotypical or, you know, primitive views about things. But if you're a community psychologist, it's a great opportunity. So the next question is, why? Why do you think this? And through the discussion, it turns out this person has never seen anyone recover from addiction, ever.
Mm.
And he'd never heard of it. He never thought it happened. There were no books written about it or anything like that. And so that was a great revelation for me. If you've never seen anything happen, why would you think it's possible?
Yeah.
And it was just as simple as that.
That's why empathy is so hard.
Empathy is really, really hard. You have to have actual contact with, you know, suffering in order to have empathy about that suffering.
Yeah. And unless you're like going out and finding it, I mean, sometimes, you know, you happen to live in a privileged life. And if you're not like, hey guys, we should probably go down to the homeless shelter and help out and see what's going on, you're never going to see people that are like homeless or have problems or see that there's a human being who's doing it, like having this trouble. Gosh, that's such a revelation. What an interesting thing. Was that like early on when you first moved there?
It was, so I'd been here a couple times. The first long-term stay here in Bulgaria was in 2009. And this was when I was in grad school. I was here on a Fulbright doing some research. And so that was a big opening. I mean, that really opened my eyes a lot. And so I never took it for granted at that point that I never said in my head, these people should blah, blah, blah.
Right.
These people, you know, because, and also the thing, it revealed a lot about the culture that I come from and what we think is possible. I mean, Americans are almost insanely optimistic people, you know, even today with everything that's going on in the United States, we're pretty sure that we're going to be able to change the system back to how it was and get everything back on track at some point.
The other day I saw this meme and it said, in a world full of Trumps, be a Carter. And that was the most optimistic, like, I believe that, you know, if we just get a good president or you can be as kind hearted as this one president, you can be better. I was like, you're right. Like, I was feeling so low at that moment. And when I saw that, I was like, that's the optimism I needed.
Yep. Yep. And
it's like,
and,
what?
You know, and it's like, and it's not just, oh, I just feel better now. It's like, yes, now I can get up and I can do the good fight.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Now it's like, now I have a purpose. I'm like, okay, cool. I'll build houses. I'll talk about peanuts. Right. It's going to be great.
It's really possible.
That's so interesting.
And it doesn't really exist here.
Yeah.
And then how it And how it relates to improv is, you know, my improv partner, she lives in Moscow. She's a Brit and she lives in Moscow. And we perform together and we rehearse over Skype. We go to festivals together. And so she's, the improv community, in English-speaking improv community in Moscow is really small. And she has a lot of the same frustrations seeing performers and teaching it as I do here in Bulgaria. And so we talk a lot about this. And the difference is that they come from cultures where there is a right way of doing things. And we know in improv there's some good general principles that we like to teach, but there is no right way to do it. Otherwise, we would just give you a script and you would just do it. And so when you're fearful all the time of doing the wrong thing, you're just going to go to this lowest common denominator. When we think about what we did early on in all of our improv careers, it was, you know, a lot of stuff based on fear. And, you know, just making dumb choices or unhelpful choices based on this fear. And so when you have that really deeply ingrained in your culture, it's really hard to just tell them, hey, be free. There's no mistakes. You know, don't worry about it. It's like telling people, you know, change the way you breathe or to change the way you think about everything that you've thought about in your life up until then. It's really tough. It's also really rewarding when people
open up. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's so interesting. But, what's your improv partner's name?
Her name is Frances Ransome, Ransome.
Awesome. It's just such an interesting thing that, like, you're in Bulgaria and she's in Moscow, and they're doing improv, not only separately and you're like pals just chatting about how you're international and you're dealing with different cultures, but that you also perform together. Like, that's super wild. Even the, like, idea that you're, like, Skype rehearsing, I love this. This is so, like the cross culture, not only because it's like, it's truly widening improv in a way that it really needs to be. Like, when I mentioned empathy earlier, it's because that's what I think of when I think of improv. I think, like, I'm helping people to exercise their empathy muscles. And in the world that I feel like I'm in, but clearly I'm in a, as usual, I'm in a magical wonderland and I don't realize it. But you know, I try to make people have more empathy, be more open to different ways of looking at stuff and to try to see from everybody's different point of view why they might see that. It, in small part because, you know, it makes it easier for acting. In my opinion. And then also because I feel like the yes and is also in a larger community grasp. Like when you say yes and to a scene and you're in this class, you're yes anding this community. You're also yes anding like a kind of comedy that people sometimes look down on. You're yes anding a whole group of people that decided to work together. You're yes anding a community. And what turns out is you're yes anding an international community of people interested in figuring out where this goes. And the idea of that is just so awesome. When it comes to just a group, knowing that there are so many people in the world right now trying so hard to just empathize, to understand, to see the world through somebody else's eyes. And I think that that's super admirable and so interesting that you guys have worked together in that way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I agree. I think that's the great power of improv. And, you know, you go to these international festivals and it just has a great, great vibe. And, you know, people from all over the world. We just, a couple of weeks ago, the fourth Sofia Improv Festival happened. It was the biggest one in terms of people coming in from out of town that we've ever had. I think there was 120 people here from countries all over Europe and the United States. Europe and Eastern Europe and the Balkans came to this. We have this one group from the United States. And you could spot, you know, the Americans a mile away among all these Europeans. Oh, just loud.
Oh yeah.
American, just loud and you know, laughing and just smiling for no reason, which is, you know, completely irrational from a European standpoint.
Smiling for no reason.
The style of play is crazy, and yeah.
The style of play is crazy. Interesting. So let's talk about that, because I was very, I'm kind of fascinated about how it's got to be different. And it's got to be different not only in Eastern Europe, but then also there's this added element of you and your British partner playing, and yet you're inspired by all this other stuff. That must just be some wild duo stuff. But but like, as far as when you're, when I teach improv, I try to focus on comedy format so that it eases their mind about like how much they're revealing about themselves, you know, or how much they feel like they have to do as far as like creation. You know, a lot of times they're like, I got to be funny. And I'm like, no, I'm going to show you this format. You just put your information in that format and it should work. And it doesn't always, but it helps them to kind of grasp the format of a scene and the flow of a scene. And then it also makes them distracted. And then they do the thing without deeply worrying about being funny or what they're saying and stuff like that. Cause they're really focused on like, okay, I got to get to the second beat. How do I say another thing that's like this, you know? So, for you, what are the ways that you find you communicate like best with your students? What's the tone or the vibe that you give to this crowd that maybe, you know, is different culturally to get them to do grounded, funny scenes?
Well, so with the University Improv Club, it's really just getting them to be, to get them to not think and to just react and make associations. All the sort of the classical sort of short form exercises, we do a lot of that, and I do it over and over and over again. We do, you know, I'm a tree for, you know, 10 minutes and to do it as fast as possible, or five things to get them sort of in that associative mindset. And then we do a lot of freeze tag just to get their brain looking at a scene and just being able to jump in and not so much worry about relationships and so on. So it's this sort of short form, quick, and have a genuine reaction to the things that are going on in those short form things. And that generally works pretty well.
Yeah. The speed distracts them.
And also they can rack up a lot of successes very, very quickly. And if they think something falls flat, they can just move past it very quickly and hopefully learn from that and so on. Then I coach another group of mostly made up of English speaking Bulgarians, and we do long form. And we've done a couple things like Pretty Flower, but mostly they do Harold. And so they have this format, and they feel much more comfortable having a format to go on. And the thing that I try and train them to do is to just connect with their scene partner emotionally in a real relationship scenario, and really actually care about each other and do not try to be funny. Just react to your scene partner. And again, really, really tough for them to do that because they don't know each other very well, and they don't trust each other. And so we'll play with games like status and having, you know, coming into a scene and noticing the different status. And, you know, status is looked upon very, very differently here than the training I got in the United States, because we do status games. You know, is a warm up or an exercise, and you make somebody slightly high status and slightly low status, and the high status person will always treat the low status person terrible, just terrible.
Oh yeah.
And the low status person will always try to cheat the high status person out of something and make them look like a fool. And I'll say to them, you know, before everything, okay, just know, you know each other and like each other. Even though your statuses are different, you know each other and like each other. And after the scene where the high status person shits on the low status person and vice versa, I'll say, you know, why does that happen? And they'll look at me like I'm crazy. Like, why would a high status person ever treat a low status person well? Why would they ever do that? And I said, because they know each other and like each other. And it's like, well, why would they like each other? A high status person has no reason to like a low status person. And I'm like, okay, well, like a butler, you know, working with, somebody they've been in the household, they served this person for many years, maybe generationally. It's like, yeah, they would always treat them like shit.
Okay. Is there a way to flip it and make comedy? Like, be like, okay, guys, do this. And then they do that scene that you expect them to do. And then you're like, okay, cool. I want you guys to go in and the same scene, except for the high status person really needs something from the low status person. So even though he's being a jerk, he needs to get something. And then maybe what they expect to happen sort of is there, because one of the things I'm teaching a sketch comedy class, and one of the things I'm always saying is what we expect to have happen, because whatever we expect is what the audience would expect, so we need to give them something different. So they're like, okay. And you know, I get like 4,000, you know, bad suggestions of where to go and then one that's good, but just using that brain, that part of the brain helps the comedy, certainly helps me think of it. I would be fascinated. God, I need to come to Bulgaria and try to work with people and teach and exercise, because I would love to watch this in real time. Like, it's so fascinating to me that not only are you trying to do something that's so like, you know, fun and well-meaning, but like you have to wade through cultural differences to try to even accomplish the task. And that both you and the students, like they're like, yeah, we want to do this so much with you, but we don't even know how we could accomplish this. Like, what do you mean? Yes. Like I was told say no first and then see how it goes. Like, you know, yeah. And I know that I've certainly got grandparents like that. But yeah, I mean, when you're putting this together, when you're working with your students, or rather, let's talk a little bit, I guess, about the troupe that you coach and also the stuff that you've seen at the international improv festivals. You mentioned that, you know, the Americans are stick out like a sore thumb, you know, we're smiling all the time and our formats are wildly different. What are the show formats internationally, like in Europe, that are so different? Is it more slow play, or is it rather faster short form stuff? How is it different in your mind?
So the theme of the festival that we just had was light and dark. And so light, you know, was being deliberately funny, comedic and stuff, and dark, meaning you could take on dark subjects. And so this sort of the premier performers who were also teaching the workshop, they would do a light show and they would do a dark show. And, you know, with mixed and interesting results. In general, improv here in Europe is slower. It is not nearly so game-based. It is much more dramatic. Part of that is because the people who do improv in Europe, the vast majority are trained actors or trained performers or trained in clowning, and they've gone to university and have learned those things. And so they take the performance craft aspect of improv very, very seriously. They know how to project, they know how to emote, they know how to do all of these things. And so improv is an additional tool in which all those other things can happen. And it can be very dramatic, it can be very serious, and so on. And so for me, coming from, you know, Chicago and seeing, you know, A Million Heralds, or seeing, you know, loads and loads of independent teams that have come up with their own sorts of format, seeing the sort of slower paced improv can sometimes be very, very frustrating. Part of it is because I have seen these other formats and these other styles, and I enjoy it very much. Occasionally, there'll be a very slow, dramatic, or intense improv that I'll enjoy, but generally, I don't. That's one of the other differences. And then it sort of differs by country. The Northern Europeans, they love dramatic improv. They love taking on serious subjects. And, you know, frankly, to me, it's just a bad excuse to talk about incest and divorce and violence. And I find it very unsatisfying and with very little justification. I've seen very few shows that have been, that treated the subject with the amount of respect it deserves.
Huh. Yeah. Interesting. And certainly didn't make fun of it. There's no like comedy in there. They're not like making fun of divorce, are they?
No, they're not.
Yeah, it's like a serious.
They are. They're treating it absolutely seriously.
Okay.
But you know, two people are on stage and they hate each other, and it's like, okay, that's fine. Why do you hate each other? I don't know why.
Yeah.
I just see a lot of tension and shouting, and I don't see why that should. It's just not compelling for me.
Interesting.
On the other hand, you have these French groups, and French has a lot of, the French groups I've seen have a lot of training and clowning and mime and physicality, and they bring it into their improv, and it's just great. Their object work is stellar. Their interactions with each other, it's almost like watching a live puppet show. If you want to see great teamwork, you know, go watch a puppet show, and you see these, you know, the people manipulating the puppets, and they're just working great together. They know each other. They know where each other is standing all the time. That's like watching the French groups. It's really a joy to see them perform because they have this additional training. And then the other groups that have really serious acting chops, but also believe in that improv is essentially a comedic art form. They do great. I really enjoy seeing really good actors do comedic improv. It's really a lot of fun to do. I don't think it's necessary to be a great actor or to have acting training to be a good improviser, but watching people who do have that and put it all together is really great.
Yeah, it's so interesting, your point of view. Like, it's funny too, like you came from Chicago, it was all fast and crazy, and now it's a little bit slower and harder, but like even just the idea of it, like the effort that they put into it, and like I would be fascinated to work a little bit more on dramatic improv, if only just, you know, to answer those questions you have, where it's like, okay, these people are angry, why are they angry? And for me, from my point of view, my mind immediately goes to like what exercises could I do so that every time somebody expresses an emotion, they automatically tell us why they're feeling that emotion so that it would really help storytelling. like all of a sudden they get super mad and they're like, I'm super mad because you didn't come home last night when you said you were going to. It's like, great. It's like the way we all hope we could be communicative in relationships, but instead try to do it on stage. Cause I'm always, one of the big things I do in level one is I'll say, if you don't say it out loud, it doesn't exist. I don't care if you thought it doesn't exist.
Well, that's amazing because, again, the Northern European improv that I've seen, the dramatic stuff, they will deliberately not say anything. And sort of the joke is between me and other improvisers who I will remain nameless is that you want to be really dramatic, walk and stare out the window, the imaginary window. And it's like, I have no patience for this, right? And the other person's talking to you and you're deliberately ignoring them. You're not responding. And I've been in workshops with improvisers who do this. And the instructor said, so when somebody says a line, you should react to it. And they're like, whoa, 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 whoa. That's really fast and really intense. And it's like, really? Why would you let five lines go by from your scene partner before you're even choosing to acknowledge or react to any of them? I mean, it boggles my mind, but that's
crazy.
What they make it work somehow. And
so fascinating. The different
people
styles.
People like it. Yeah. And so that's the really cool thing / frustrating thing about travel, being internationally, being in a place that you don't know how things work. And you know, if the waiting in line is really just chaos and there's no line, it's very frustrating if you don't know that rule. If ignoring your scene partner is a totally legitimate way of doing improv, it's very frustrating if you've never really done that before, you've never trained to do that. So,
yeah. Interesting. Man, the breadth of improv that you see is just amazing. Now,
I feel so fortunate to be here. And my scene partner, the group is called Decent Freaks, and we're going to Oslo to take some classes with some of my favorites from the United States, Jason Shaw, Craig Euler, Stacey Smith, Endel Sudik. You know, people that I know and love and will be really happy to see. And then other Americans that I don't know. Susan Messing is coming to Oslo and get to see them play and so on. And then my scene partner and I, were performing in the show and we're just very, very happy and flattered to do that. We did it last year and it was a lot of fun. So
that's
we're
so great.
Very happy to do that. But what's that?
I said, that's so great. I love that you're going to Oslo. That's super fun.
Oh, yeah.
A fun festival coming up. I want to hear all about it. I mean, well, you know, send me a picture or something.
And, you know, she came here. We took classes together in Sofia. I've been to Moscow to do an improv festival with her there. We've gone to Copenhagen. You know, I've been to Finland. There's still a ton of other festivals all over the place that we haven't gone to. We haven't yet to go to Poland and yet to go to Germany for the Improv Fest there. But we've seen performers from all of those places. And so you kind of get a feel for what they're like. There's a very distinctive vibe, in pretty much every single country, that comes and performs. And part of it is just because the founders, that's just how the founders of the scene there, how they interpret improv, mixed in with the culture and how the culture views what is funny.
The more I'm learning from different improvisers across the world, the more I just realize how much of what I know in improv and what I even practice is so small. Like, just, I only know this. I only know this style. You know, I only know certain things. I mean, I've done a lot of workshops and whatnot to help develop the breadth, but it's so fascinating to hear of different stuff, you know, that's happening all around. And like, even to think of like, when you guys go, so when you and Francis go to festivals, do you guys like take a workshop together to like get into a little group mind before you perform, or like how do you connect? Because like you're doing a lot of your rehearsing separately. What's the way that you guys come together and become connected for your performances?
Well, at this past festival, we took a workshop together, but it was specifically designed for two person team.
Nice.
And so we had 2 days of classes with this amazing Israeli improviser named Inbal Lori, and she lives in Berlin, and she does a lot of two-person shows. And she just, you know, watched us perform individually, you know, and then on stage as a team for 2 days, and just gave us notes and helped us out immeasurably, picking out all the things we do well and all the things we don't. In Oslo, we're taking a similar 2-day class taught by Jason Shaw called the Two Person Show. And so in Dummy, he and Colleen are just one of the all-time great, you know, two-person shows I've ever seen. So that's a great opportunity. So we'll connect in those in those classes. And then we spend a lot of time just geeking out and just getting to know each other, what we love and what we like to do, and to just throw those, you know, pieces that we love at each other and seeing the other person react to it. And then we do little warm-ups, directly before shows, just to make sure that we're on the same page and we're just super tuned in and listening to each other. I love two-person shows, and I love performing with Frances because she'll react to everything and anything that I throw out. And very, very, very little gets by her. And because she always reacts, I always have something to react to. And so, you know, I'll end up doing my thing and coming up with like little details of stuff. And then she'll just, you know, latch onto one of those things and we'll just go from there.
Awesome.
And people, you know, we've gotten some really nice feedback and people seem to like it. And, you know, we've never even come close to doing something that we thought was a perfect show. But, you know, we just love being together and performing together and just kind of seeing where it goes.
That's so great. I'm so glad that you have a fun troupe that you get to travel with and develop with, and that, you know, things are going really well at the university. Thank you so mm-hmm. much for talking to me. I really appreciate you being on the podcast. You have, you're very inspiring, and I'm very fascinated by all the things you're doing. And I think, you know, it's just, you're one of the coolest international improvisers to me, because you're, I mean, I guess because I identify with you the most because you're American, and, you know, you're going on this journey and you really see it with this amazing breadth. When you talk about, you know, knowing the way America would culturally understand it, and then being able to see the breadth of different ways that people are dealing with, you know, their lives, you know, reacting to other people, relationships, all the things that you're working on in your psychology classes, it's really great. And I'm glad you're out there, because it's good to know that there are people who sort of care and are viewing the world in this wider view, instead of being like, my way or the highway, you know, like that's it. So
it really is a big, thank you, Amy. That's very, very kind of you to say. Yeah, it really is a big wide world out there. And thanks for doing the podcast, and, you know, keep up the great work with that as well.
And by the way, thank you for doing this 3 times. This is the third time.
Okay. Third
You're
time.
The best. Woo. Extra special for you. The most. I'll believe me. It'll be all over the post.
we love technology. We do.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com, or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.